Welcome to Fresh from the Field Fridays by the Produce Industry Podcast, your weekly download on supply trends, category updates, brand awareness, and what's hot in the market. Join us each week from San Francisco Bay, California, as we cover all aspects of the produce supply chain industry. Ladies and gentlemen, here's your host, Dan, the Produce Man.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Fresh from the Field Fridays on this lovely, lovely Friday here in the San Francisco Bay. Dan, the Produce Man, here with you, and today's Fresh from the Field Fridays is brought to you by the Produce Industry Podcast and sponsored by Buck Naked Onions, Equifruit, the only banana you should buy, Sunray's snack with impact. Oh, yes, folks, and how about those Bell Harvest apples? Folks, Dan the Produce Man here with you. Today we have a special guest, a good buddy of mine I did a lot of business with in the produce industry several years ago when I had Dan's fresh produce. Well, hey, can still have it. Just have it right here in your ear instead. Adam Sanders is with me, and Adam was the proprietor of Copala Organics, which he's going to explain to us what that is, C-O-P-O-L-A. He was a political asylum attorney and a whole lot more. So let's just jump right into it, because Adam has some great stories and some great information for us. Adam, welcome to Fresh from the Field Fridays.
Thank you, Dan. It's so great to be here. I have such fond memories of your store and working with you, and so glad that you're continuing advocating for fresh produce. I did have a business called Copala Organics. Copala is a name attached to a region of western Oaxaca up high in the mountains, an area known as the Mixteca Alta. I had worked with many political refugees prior to becoming an attorney, actually, and specifically indigenous peoples from southern Mexico. And these were highly screened cases where they were having very legitimate political persecution. And when they came to this country, many were working in the fields, yet they had this amazing ability and skill to grow organic produce and just about anything on steep mountainsides. And this was a skill that was not being tapped into.
Oh, yeah. You brought plenty of just amazing vegetables to my store through these growers.
Absolutely. And part of the story is when the folks were coming here or fleeing from the indigenous people fleeing from Mexico, they encountered extreme racism and exploitation among the Latino community here. And a big part of that led to us starting a group to help educate people in their rights through a culturally and linguistically correct manner. And one thing that I noticed is people were almost always discussing the difficult things that were happening in their life and had happened in their life, such as, you know, village burning, sniper shooting into schools, people talking about their cousin or their father who was just killed or kidnapped. And again, this had nothing to do with narco-politics. This was just straight politics, which is an interesting story. But its nexus to produce is that the only time I really saw people relaxed and happy is when they would talk about what they used to grow and the food they used to eat high up in their villages, many at that time, early 2000s, lacking electricity. And so we got together and we found 3 acres and started a community farm, and it was called the Oaxacan Children's Garden.
Ah, yes. When you started this farm, the 3-acre farms, this actually expanded to other farms as well, because I remember when you took me down to look at the farms, we went to several different locations.
Absolutely. And so what we did is we wrote a grant through Honor the Earth and the Health Commission, I believe, and got a small grant. But we did a lot of work on this 3 acres that had been a place where people would just go and throw old auto parts, et cetera. And it was a consensus-led base, which was important because political choice and control had been removed from these people. So I just didn't want to be the white guy there making all the decisions. So we formed committees and everything was done by consensus. And what was really amazing is part of this 3 acres was on a hill. We used the hill to get a really large water tanker, 20,000 gallons, and do gravity-powered irrigation. And we also did a farming method, growing corn and beans in a really unique way, something I hadn't seen. When I saw how amazing these families were at growing, and here they were breaking their backs in the fields 14 hours a day. We connected with ALBA, which is an incubator farm program down south of Salinas. We used some of the grant money to help people fax in applications and buy gas cards, and many began this incubator farm program and began working for themselves. And it was really amazing, Dan, because here people would work in the fields all day, would then be working on their own half an acre incubator find by truck light, and eventually growing into full-time farmers. And many of them are extremely successful. Some have 5, some have 10, some have 15, some have 200 acre farms at this time. And those were the farms that you saw.
Sure, I remember them clearly. Now, but let's go back to old auto parts field, the original farm. I mean, cleaning all those auto parts out of there, and because this became organic farming, so you had a lot of work to do there. That in itself had to be a huge task.
It really was, and it was really great because everybody was involved. The little kids were out there, and so many people had, again, these skills and connections. So we were, first we had to remove a giant pile of sawdust where they had fallen eucalyptus trees and chopped them up, and you know, eucalyptus is not good for soil.
Right.
So first we had to haul out mountains and mountains of wood chips, and then we needed to pull out, and we've been spading the field and trying to disc it with a short disc so that we wouldn't break any discs when we borrow a tractor. And then everybody would go through and pull out layer after layer of rocks. And first we started with big boulders that sometimes we'd have to roll, then carry, and then, you know, softball-sized rocks, and then finally into pebbles. And we eventually got it down to where it was good, you know, good soil, and were able to plant. And we did berms that were about 100, anywhere between 100 and 150 feet long and about a meter wide, and raised them. And it was great. And it was really beautiful to see, like, the way we were able to mix modern farming techniques such as drip irrigation with the old method of growing. And if you're interested, I could briefly talk about that.
Sure, because that cleanup process took about how long?
That took about a year just to get it ready to plant.
Okay, that's what I figured. Well, you also said it was on a hillside, correct?
Correct. Part of it was on a slanting hillside. And so we did the berms kind of like terraces, not full terraces with rocks. But that could have been intimidating to many farmers, but this is exactly how the mountains were in their part of Oaxaca, and so it was no problem. And in between the berms, we would dig about a 2.5 foot hole, about 2.5 feet in diameter, and into the bottom of that, we would plant 3 corn kernels and 4 beans. And what was really cool is these beans that we were growing were from microclimates up in the cloud forests. Many of these beans, I had somebody who was an expert look at them, and he was just fascinated because these bean pods, and you bought many of those, Dan, these bean pods would sometimes have 12, 15 beans in them, and they had amazingly vibrant colors, and the beans from one village that was in one valley would be somewhat different than beans in the other. So we were taking thousands of year old developed beans and planting them with the corn.
But corn must have acted as a beanstalk, because I know that's a very old-fashioned or even ancient method of growing beans. Is that correct? The beans would go around the corn?
They would, and sometimes this is known as the three sisters, right? The squash, and the beans, and the corn. But what I had seen here with the indigenous Oaxacan folks was what I hadn't seen elsewhere, is planting deep down inside the hole, and this goes back to the hillside growing, and then the three corn stalks growing together would kind of support each other instead of having just one stalk. And then as they grew and they got, you know, about 3-4 feet high, then you would go and plow the berm that's in between, or just spade it and shore up with a mound of dirt around the base of the three stalks. And when the hole was open, this would allow runoff water, which is, I'm told, part of what would happen in the mountains because they didn't have the irrigation there. The runoff water from the rain would stay in the hole and it would provide nutrients. And then as the roots needed to be deeper, you just push the mound of dirt up around. And then, the beans grow up the trellis. And then these are a meter apart, the corn, the patches of corn, these three bunches, which is something I hadn't seen elsewhere.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And then you could plant squash in between, and the shade of the leaves would help keep the weeding down. Because this was all purely organic, and you end up weeding 4, 5, 6 times, whereas on a conventional farm, you might weed once or twice.
So the experience that the Oaxacan farmers had, it was already being done organically. So here, where people want to transition from conventional from all the chemicals and everything else to organic. What they did was they brought their centuries-old methods of growing to this location in where? In Salinas? Where was this? In Watsonville?
The original farm was in Hollister.
Okay, that's right, a Hollister. So they brought that old method, which was already organic, here. So to them, it just came natural, is what you're telling us.
It did. And also, you know, crop planning, understanding the cycles, you know, which is really important. And, you know, many were working on conventional farms and they were disturbed. You know, we would hear about how they'd have itching eyes,
right.
The skin would be burning. And to me, this is a really beautiful thing. So many of these folks that I was with, they were so grateful to come to a place that was safe. And this is their words. And many would say to me, you know, we would not have left a place where our people have been for 1,000 years, except it's better to live than to die. And they saw growing organic food and putting that into our commerce as their way to give back to this country that has made a place for them. And I think that was really neat. The other cool thing is, when you're talking about a small farm, and this is where getting the produce, what my business was helping to get the produce and up to higher value markets instead of selling to, like, starting with a half an acre or 1 acre. So if you're starting out with a small farm and you grow cilantro and carrots and you sell those even organic ones for $10 a box to the local cooler, that's great if you can grow 50 acres. But
right.
We could also have specialty items that people would give us a higher price for. And some of those were things directly from Oaxaca that we would introduce into the restaurants in the East Bay. Or they were something that was known to the chefs, but it was difficult to access. One example being chipil, which the El Comal restaurant there in the Gourmet Ghetto in Berkeley, the chef Gannon there really enjoyed that. Papa Loquelite.
We used to sell that, yes.
You did, absolutely. And another cool thing is that in the smaller farms, things that are considered weeds to big farmers but are edible, such as purslane, it's known as Verdo Lagas or pig's weed, and the wild amaranth that would grow,
yes.
And other herbs. I'm trying to think. And then I think this is a great story that relates to you, Dan, is do you want to tell the folks a bit about your kale pop tops?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You brought me these kale pop tots. Wait a minute. Let me say that again. Kale pop tops, not kale pop tarts, folks. Kale pop tops. And these are really cool because no other store had these. And they were organically grown. And they were pretty much just the crown of the kale plants, wasn't it, Adam? Isn't that what it was?
That's right.
Delicious.
Absolutely. If you drive by a field with kale, you'll see how the leaves have been picked and it continue to grow. When it would get into its last stage, oftentimes when I would be picking things up at the field at 5 a.m, I would go by and just pop these tops off. One time I just popped one in my mouth. It was delicious. And I said, who do I know that's crazy enough to buy, you know, 3 different 5-gallon buckets of different colored kale tops? And you know who that was. That was you, Dan.
Yes. But, you know, a lot of those ended up in our boxes, our CSA boxes, because we truly were CSA boxes because we brought things in like that and from small local farms. And some of them also went down the street to a high-end restaurant, California Cuisine, and he went nuts over them. So they did make their way to some really cool places.
Absolutely. Oh, and the other thing is the nettle tops, the stinging nettle tops.
Oh, yes. Those
yes.
were great.
Yeah, and we sold those to lots of restaurants. One time, you know, if any of you listeners ever have a chance to go to Pizza Hacker in the Mission, it's a great pizza place. The guy's an absolute fanatic about the top quality ingredients. And he did they've got kind of a punk rock theme there, at least they did, and he called it a heavy nettle pizza.
Oh, you gotta love it, man. Yeah. Heavy nettle pizza. I want a heavy nettle pizza.
And Cheese Board did that as well, so absolutely.
Yeah, Cheese Board is gone now, unfortunately. But you also did with Nito's, and Nito's is, they're back. They moved to an outdoor location during lockdown, but now they have both locations again. I know you did some business with them.
Oh, they were just absolutely fantastic people. Head chef Jose,
he's
became
a
friend
guy.
With him. Absolutely. And Corey and the other owner, she's going to kill me. I'm missing her name. But they were really supportive and also very exacting. I really appreciated working with places in the East Bay and places like your shop that really demanded quality produce that was fresh and well cared for. And one of the things that we did, especially for the restaurants, mainly for the restaurants, is that we had a guarantee to, I'd say 90% of the time, we were able to bring produce within 24 hours of it being harvested.
I loved that. I loved being able to tell a customer, yesterday at this time, this was still in the field growing. I loved to be able to do that.
Absolutely. And that was kind of the model into this business. I grew up in Siskiyou County in a logging family, multi-generation timber falling family, hunters, fishers, trappers. And my mom used to have a little vegetable garden, and I kind of was looking at growing. And I said to my dad, hey, why don't we grow more? We've got land. And he said, oh, if you farm, you're tied to the land. You can't just jump in the truck and go hunting whenever you want to, et cetera. So he's like, wait, that's not for us. That's for flatlanders, you know? Well, I found when I moved down there to Hollister in that area, I really got addicted to growing things. And it was just amazing for me. But I'm not my skill set. So while I was good at organizing and doing some gardening, when I tried after I left my job because of having cancer and then eventually recovering, I tried to kind of grow and be a farmer too. And these guys, indigenous Oaxacan folks, came to me and like two or three came and said, you know, Adam, you're really not so good at growing, but you're really good at talking. So we think it'd be good if you tried to help us sell. And so again, I wasn't trying to be the bulk guy because there's plenty of those places in Salinas, and Alba had a cooler and they were very helpful to the farmers as well. So I wasn't trying to cut into that. What we were trying to do is to just get these niche items and even everyday items, but of a higher quality, freshly harvested, into a few places up in the East Bay. And it was really growing and it was really doing well, and the farmers have continued, and many are still farming. We're always going to need food.
Yes, in fact, after you retired from that particular portion of your life, I continued to buy from Oya Organics.
Right.
And there was one other that used to come up. His name was Ephraim, and I'm trying to remember his farm too. Might not have been connected with yours, but you had this umbrella, Kapala, in organics. My store, Adam, and as you know, was a store where we carried things that you just couldn't get in the big stores. You couldn't go to the Safeway. You couldn't go to Albertsons or any of these other places and get these things. And not just the produce, but a lot of the grocery items too, because, you know, if I was just doing the same thing everybody else was doing, then what good would it be? We made it a destination, and your growers really helped out with that, and you helped out with that quite a bit. So it was a real pleasure to do that. Now, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our wonderful sponsors. And when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about a Sound of Freedom type situation that Adam shared with me one night, a story, something that he was involved in. Hang on tight to your seats, because this is really going to blow your mind. We'll be back after this.
In the morning, I always pour a cup of coffee and grab a banana. Before Equifruit, I never thought twice about how my banana was farmed. And now that I'm a banana badass, I care about fair trade, which ensures fair pay, gender equity, and safe working conditions. This is why Equifruit is the only banana you should buy.
Everyone, we have an APB out on a buck naked onion. This onion is produced by Owyhee Produce, so we have to be on the lookout. Whether you're a retailer, food service distributor, or a wholesaler, this onion is whole, it's hearted, and it's a buck naked, everyone. To all you civilians out there, please, let's catch this buck naked onion.
I love grapes.
Whoa, what's this?
Dude, that's a snack with impact.
Wait, what?
You know, sun rays. They are the snack with impact. All their grapes and mandarins are certified, sustainably grown, so you know the planet and people are being taken care of. And they make a donation to save the children with every package pack, so kids can thrive around the world.
No way. So every time I have Sunray's grape or mandarin, I'm making the world a better place?
Duh. That's why they call it the snack with impact.
We'll be right back.
All right, folks, welcome back to Fresh from the Field Fridays. Adam Sanders, always one of my most interesting friends to talk to, that's for sure. And there are many stories, so we'll probably have to have him back in the future again to share some more. But one night after you brought some produce to me, Adam, I had closed the store. We were sitting in my office talking. I was probably preparing my buy sheet, and we were yakking it up like we would do. And you told me this story, blew my mind completely. And it was how you had worked on rescuing this gal from a village, I think. Well, why don't you share that story with us?
Sure, I will. And first I'll say, Dan, if this had been even a few 5 years earlier, I wouldn't have shared anything about this because to protect the privacy of the entire community. Of course, I would never mention any names or even what town the person is from.
Sure.
But until about 5 years ago, a lot of the issues that were happening in this part of Oaxaca and the Mixteca Alta region was in a shroud of secrecy. But now it's been widely reported on in the press, and there's been lots of doctorate students and anthropologists and political scientists who have written about it. And they were writing about it even, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, but it wasn't widely read. So I do feel comfortable sharing some of this now. But the issue, and one thing I want to make clear, is that when people hear about, you know, corruption or violence in Mexico, our mind automatically goes to narco politics. And at this situation with these indigenous people that I worked with had nothing to do with narcotics. It was completely political. And to first understand that the Mexican political system is truly multi-party. And so since there are so many parties, there will be coalitions made, and these coalitions can be a big player in politics. And so if you control, you know, I've been told that if you even control 5,000 votes in a state, you can really make a difference politically. And kind of the broad basis of this is that in these indigenous areas that have a real communal mindset, and where because of racism and exploitation and state violence, the community we really have to be together and kind of go mostly as a group.
And you said earlier that the racism was mainly from the Latino community towards the indigenous peoples of Mexico. Is that correct?
Yes. And of course, it wasn't the entire community, but there was
right.
Yeah, there is a, in Mexico, there is a very well-known racist attitude towards indigenous people. And so the mestizo, or the people that are mixed European blood and indigenous, plus the more European folks, often have a very racist attitudes towards indigenous people. And that feeds into exploitation and almost an apartheid system. Not as much now, thankfully, but especially in the early 2000s and even up into 10 years ago, we would see this in replayed in the towns and farms of Central Coast. And, you know, for example, somebody, I was able to bring attention to some attorneys' case where a labor contractor had about 70 people living on a piece of property had, and we're charging between $150 and $300 a month for each person, and some of them were sleeping on dirt in a PVC pipe structure with just tarp spread over it, no electricity. And when we did the investigation and lawsuit, we found that the same person owned other rentals and other places, and it was all either mestizo people or Caucasian people. It was only the indigenous workers that he had living in this ways and completely exploiting them. We saw wage theft. We saw refusal to have a translator. It was just really, really brutal. We'd even see attacks in the fields. One story where a supervisor was so angry that an older indigenous man didn't speak Spanish, he grabbed him by the coat and started dragging him behind the four-wheeler. And again, this is not representative of the entire community, but I'm just simply stating what I saw in the niche area that I was. And of course, then people started kind of organizing and getting together, and then the laws changed, or not that the laws changed, but attorneys found out about this. Great places like California Rural Legal Assistance or private attorneys to help, and with community education. And now it is truly better. But this goes back into southern Mexico, where the indigenous people had, you know, somewhat ostracized or isolated, and political power taken away from them. So, and I don't want to get into a long lecture. I do sometimes do long presentations on these, but the idea is that if a sociopolitical group that usually has a paramilitary wing can trade block votes to someone in the government or to a party, then they will get in turn all the development projects, the school development money, even the food, you know, the money for food that they can control. And then sometimes just donations, quote unquote, to their sociopolitical organization. And more importantly, impunity. To do whatever it takes to get these forced participation. So one of those ways would be in marches, so forced political marches, and they would empty the schools and everybody had to go. They would keep a list of who did and didn't go. If you didn't go to the march, you'd get a warning. If you didn't go to the march a second time, you might have a fine and maybe even like a public beating. And then more than that, oftentimes people would be killed, or you would be threatened with having your daughter taken away from you. And this is important because if you show up at the government capital of your region with 2,000 marchers, now you put on a show, right? You show that you've got political muscle, and then it's good for the government official to show that he's working with indigenous people, et cetera.
Sure, sure. But, you know, that happens here, too. You don't get the threats and you don't get the beatings or your daughter taken away from you, but there's a lot of paid protesters at a lot of these marches, or just here in the U.S., too. A lot of paid ones.
And here they certainly were not paid, and it was part of this. So the interesting thing is that in these villages, an exercise of rights that we would take for granted were seen as going against the group and against the leadership, against the agencia, which is like a town hall. It's the smallest fractionalization of government power in Mexico, no matter what that was. And the traditional norms, such as arranging a marriage or having a dowry or a bride price for the daughter, which was meant to be saved by the father originally in case she was abandoned and she'd have something to start over, it all got politicized and it all got wrapped up into this political violence. So if this political organization wanted to incorporate a new town and the leaders didn't want to go with it, then they may target the men, and they would also try to target the daughters or the girls from that town, and many times bring them to a different part of the region and sell them into marriage against their will. Or if you refuse to go along with an arranged marriage, then you were seen as going against the group, and you could be punished, sold to somebody else you didn't want. Now, this sounds hyperbolic, it sounds provocative, but it just really is the truth. And again, it is getting better, but this is what I saw and experienced. And so when I really got to know these people and they trusted me, I started to find out about these things that were happening, and we started looking for a way to help. And so eventually, through different attorneys and civil rights organizations and political asylum organizations, we were able to find attorneys to represent them for political asylum. And one of those cases where a family member said that a couple of women were being held against their will or were being threatened with being sold and were being closely watched, I didn't go down to the village myself because I would have certainly stood out and endangered people. But we were able to create a time for them to escape and to work their way up through Mexico and meet with friends and people that were willing to help us have safe houses. And then I went to the border city with them and helped them turn themselves into immigration. And this happened several times. And what happened is, you know, nothing was done. We didn't sneak through. They presented themselves to the border with information. And we did a little write-up about the political situation and that we'd had successful political asylum claims before. Then they would be processed at the border and we would have a place for them. They'd get an ankle monitor. And every person that I've worked with has had a successful asylum claim, which is not easy to get. And that just shows that the reality of their situation. And again, these were sometimes teenage women in their early 20s, who were fleeing from being forced to participate in organized marches, being under the threat of being kidnapped and sold against their will, under the threat of political rape to embarrass the families that wouldn't go with the political party. And these were just some of the tactics that were going on. And many people stood up to this. Many people tried to defend themselves. They tried to get help from the government and were ignored. And it's important to note that this kind of Wild West situation was intentional in much part because of the racism and the political power of the mainstream government. And one example is in the 1970s, when the Mexican army was in the region and there were lots of deaths. The people carried coffins, 70 coffins they carried, and put it in front of the Capitol
Wow.
of that region and said, help us. And there was no help. Another time, there was, I think this was around 1999, 2000, there were multiple murders in this village. And this was a developed town. You know, they were about to put in a university there. And the lower part of the town, because it was kind of on a mountainside and kind of snaked down a ridge, so the lower part, they left. They fled. It's like 350 to 500 people fled. They went to the government. They did sit-in. Some of them did hunger strikes and asking for help. And there was no help given.
Then,
of course, some would go back. Some people would try to leave. Some would go back and say, well, we can defend ourselves. And that just kept putting more fire on the flame. So the first young lady that I helped ended up being in custody for several months. And when I flew to where she was detained to help her and looked through the glass window, she had the biggest smile on her face. And she'd spoken very little Spanish when I met her. But now she spoke more. And she's, hello, Adam, how are you? With just this cheerful smile. And I said, wow, you sure are happy for being in custody. And, you know, she's got the jumpsuit on, you know, it's the talking through the glass and everything. She says, well, this is way better than being somewhere where I'm going to be killed.
Oh, wow.
And these are beautiful people with a beautiful culture. And again, they had a strong job skill or business skill that can really contribute to the economy of this country and really help them fulfill that American dream, which is to have your own business and be your own boss. And so many of them have done that through small organic farms that grow the bread and butter items like cilantro and all of that, but also the niche crops.
So if you go to the farmer's market, we're going to put a plug in for Oya Organics. They have grown quite a bit. They are one of the growers for Koch Farms, and there are several farms. That's why it's called Koch Farms. Christine Koch and her family started that many years ago. Charlie's Produce owns it now. But Oya used to bring me stuff directly after Adam moved on. You can find them at the farmer's market. In fact, actually, if you go to my YouTube channel, you'll see an Oya Organic Farm video that I did at the San Francisco Ferry Plaza Farmers Market with Modesto, the proprietor of that farm.
Yes, I remember Masha when she first started, and Modesto, wonderful people, extremely hard workers. We were actually roommates at one point, and she would come in just covered in dirt after working 14, 15 hours. There's lots of stories that I could tell about their journey, but that's really their story to tell, and I don't know if I have permission to share all of those. But just an amazing couple, hard work, hard scrabble farmers, started from the very, very bottom and worked their way up through sheer grit and determination and really hard work.
And that's just one of them, folks.
That's just one of
the farms. So we visited many. Well, Adam, it's been a real pleasure. Your stories are always very interesting, very full of information, and I hope it shed some light on what actually is behind some of these organic produce items that you're buying from these small local immigrant farmers, because look at everything that it took to get this to you. Their whole life is behind it and what they're doing now. And this is a whole different ball game from what's happening at our border right now with everybody coming from everywhere all over the world coming through. This was legitimate, real immigration and asylum, normal stuff, all done legally.
Yes, and you know, people should know that we do, the United States is in a treaty that we signed after World War II to allow anyone to request asylum and have a fair hearing. And so I do believe that many of the people that are at the border now do have legitimate claims. And my prior experience is that many don't. So we need to all get together and find a way to have a secure border, but allow for everybody and for us to fulfill our treaty obligations for people who have legitimate claims.
Very good. Adam Sanders, thank you for joining me here today on Fresh from the Field Fridays.
Awesome. Thank you, Dan.
Hey, folks, be sure to tune in to the Produce Industry Podcast every Monday with Patrick Kelly, as well as the Produce Industry Show on YouTube and the Produce Industry app. You gotta have that. Download that now on your smartphone, on your smartwatch, on your tablet, wherever you can download apps to. And be sure to check out the History of Produce series with John Papp, the Global Fresh Series with Juanita Gallio. Also, check out my YouTube and Rumble channels called Dan the Produce Man, and all my social media can be found at danthproduceman.com. Until next week, this is Dan the Produce Man reminding you that it's always best when you get it fresh.
You've been listening to Fresh from the Field Fridays with Dan the Produce Man. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or Anchor to get fresh weekly episodes. For more, please follow us on Instagram and Facebook at The Produce Industry Podcast and at Dan the Produce Man. Until next time, see you in the fields or on the horizon.